Ready. Boom, and we're live. What's up, man?
How's it going?
Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure
finally.
To meet you. Yeah, man.
I'm a fucking huge fan of yours.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I listened to the last album. I've listened to that fucking thing hundreds of times. I listen to it all the time when I'm headed to the comedy store. Puts me in a good mood.
Well, that's good. That's what music's supposed to do.
I'm just stunned by the fact that for the longest time, you were basically doing the songwriting thing. You were doing a lot of that. You were making your own music, but you were known more as a songwriter.
Yeah, well, you know, you walk through the doors that are open, you know.
Yeah.
So you do the things that come up, and you know, somewhere in the middle of all that, you find out what your thing is, you know.
But God damn, your voice is so good, man.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't want to fanboy out on you, but it's just such a classic, like, male voice, you know, like singing those kind of songs. It's like, I'm glad someone's still doing it right.
Oh, well, I don't know. You know, thank you. I'll also say thank you. I don't want to say I'm doing it right and somebody else is doing it wrong.
Well, for
I'm
me,
doing, it's not, I'm doing what I do, you know.
So. Well, what you do, I like.
Yeah, thank
so
you.
I'm just happy there's someone out there doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
And what is going on with you right now? You got a new album that's about to come out.
We got a new album that's, came out December 1st. And, we're proud of it and hope people like it.
Is it on iTunes and all that jazz?
It's on
iTunes.
Get it everywhere? Yeah, you can get it everywhere that music is available, as far as I know. That's what they tell me. So,
how have the doors opened up for you now? Does everything feel like,
yeah, we're sitting here talking, aren't we?
Everything's good.
No, yeah, beyond good. Good would be the understatement of the century for you know, just so many things that sound like fake. You know, like fake life.
Yeah.
You know, things that happen, phone calls you get, people you meet, people you get to talk to. And,
like what?
Shoot, man, just any of it. Just, you know, getting to go play. This past year we played 3 shows with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You know?
Oh, man.
You know?
That must have been amazing.
It was amazing. We played Wrigley Field with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wrigley Field. God.
And
how many people was that?
I don't know. It was a bunch, but it... It felt just as cool as it sounds like it should. You
wow.
know?
Man, Wrigley Field with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It doesn't get any cooler than that.
Not to me, it doesn't. Maybe there's something else.
So how long has success been happening? Like 2 years now?
To the degree that it's happening right now, you know, probably since, you know, 2015. Couple years of good strong. We're going on 3. Of, you know, doing playing shows to more people than we knew ever came to live shows. So, yeah, well, it's been, you know, a strange, life-altering thing.
When you hear, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chris Stapleton. And, what is that like? Does it freak you out?
Well, we don't usually do many announcements like that. We just kind of walk out there and play.
That's the move.
Yeah, we don't hype them up.
Good
too,
for you.
Too much. We just kind of walk out there and fire up.
Oh, that might be the way to do it.
Well, I mean, everybody has their own thing, but I don't have like a hype guy doing that.
You need like the Kiss guy. The hottest band in the world. I remember that when I was a kid. I went to see Kiss live a bunch of times. You'd get so fucking pumped up at the beginning because they would go, the hottest band in the world.
I've never seen Kiss live, but Gene Simmons did show up to a show of ours one time.
Did he really?
It was the weirdest thing ever. He sent it. We were in New York somewhere, and he just happened to be in town. Or he played the night before wherever we were playing. And he showed up and just to say hi, and here's Gene Simmons on the side of the stage before we go play our gig. And I'm just like, you know,
really?
Yeah, it's one of those moments we're talking about. You asked about people. That was one of them. It's like, hi, Gene Simmons.
Gene Simmons came to see me one time a few years back at New Year's Eve at the Improv. Him and his family came to see me New Year's Eve, and I was fucking legitimately nervous.
So the whole time you're looking at Gene Simmons going,
yeah.
Or not looking at him, you know, one way or the other, you know.
But. It was so odd.
Yeah.
It's like, you know who I am? How the fuck is that possible?
It's strange stuff, man.
So this, but I love talking to people that are like a year, 2 years into the situation you're in right now, where you're just kind of getting settled into it, where it still seems like fantasy land.
I'm not sure that it would ever not seem like fantasy land because I spent enough years not in fantasy land to realize that it's in fantasy land. You know?
Could be. You could be like 71 day on cocaine, 15 ex-wives. Just, man.
God, I hope not. That sounds horrible.
But it seems like it happens to a lot of folks, right?
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm going to hope not me.
Yeah, I hope not you too.
Yeah.
You don't, I mean, you seem like you could avoid it.
Seems like a horrid existence.
Well, there's a balancing act, I think, with any great musician or any great artist, really, is like doing the art and then now you're in the Fame Olympics. Like you're in this weird thing where, you know, you're going to win Grammys and you're going to have platinum albums if they still have those anymore. And you're going to be on these talk shows and people are going to it's a different animal now.
Well,
right?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no.
No.
For me, I mean, I still, whatever we have is because we concentrated on the music and let music lead. And so trying to do anything other than that, you know, I'll have fun with some of the stuff, you know, somebody wants me to do a bit on a show or something. I'm fine with that. That's
right.
Cool. But it still all just comes from music, you know, and it's all – the focus is always going to be the music. And anything other than that, you know, there's never, in my mind, any focus on trying to stay famous. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I knew you were going to think like that.
Yeah.
I'm very happy you said it that way.
I don't make music for that reason and or to win awards or anything like that. I make it because I like it and hope that it's – good.
Well, it's very clear in your music itself that that's what you're doing. Very clear. It's very clear that that's pure, that it's just, this is what you do, and you're concentrating on that. And it's not, there's nothing disingenuous about it. There's nothing pumped up or fake or.
Well, yeah, you hope not, you know.
Yeah, I know, right? That's the.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's got to be a weird world. I mean, the world of the music business is a very, very strange world. I've talked to a lot of musicians and, you know, the navigating the world of commerce and music. And
if you just simplify it down to let the music lead and let that kind of be always the focus, it's for me, that makes it real easy to not make what I think decisions you would regret or feel like weren't you. So as long as that's the focus, that's okay. You know, all that other stuff just kind of becomes, you know, external noise that, you know, will all – it doesn't matter. You know,
right.
It's not a hard thing to navigate in that realm to me.
To you?
To me, no.
But you must see it being a difficult thing for some folks that you know, right?
Sometimes, you know, some people you know, care very much about. This is a danger. You're the first person to ever get me in dangerous waters. Like I'm talking about people.
Oh, we don't have to name names. I'm sorry.
No. I don't want to sound judgmental in what I'm saying. My wife calls this pulling back the curtain too much. You know, she's like, don't pull back that curtain too much. But, you know, if you want to pull it back, I know that you're the guy that likes to pull back the curtain.
I think it's good to look back there sometimes.
Yeah, okay.
See what the fuck the monsters are up to.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you roll up into the music business or, you know, this is my experience. If you roll up into wanting to make records and wanting to be in the music business and wanting to make a living playing music, having absolutely no opinion of what you want to do or who you are or how you do it, and you want everybody else to tell you how to do it and what to do and when and where and why, then, yeah, it can be a confusing thing because there will be a lot of external opinions that aren't yours that will create someone that is not you that you will have to play for the rest of your life. So was that a lot of information?
No, that's right.
Moment?
Yeah.
So,
no.
You know, but as long as you're doing things that are you and do come, you know, from you and from who you are and what you like to do, that's never a wrong decision. And sometimes that doesn't add up to – most of the times it doesn't add up to some kind of commercial success. But, you know, at least you can look at yourself in the mirror on it and not – hate whatever it is you have to go out and play every night.
Right. Like, so it can become like the artistic equivalent of like a soulless corporate job where you just kind of get sucked into something. You wind up doing it for a living. Maybe it makes you money, but you never really get to be yourself because you're sort of programmed into this thing that they've sort of manufactured.
Yes. Yeah. Well, or you ignore some other passion or talent that you have under the guise of it seeming risky or irresponsible and try to go do this thing that seems like in your mind is the normal thing to do.
Like when Garth Brooks put on that wig and pretended to be that other dude. Remember that part? Well, do you remember that thing?
I do remember that thing.
Yeah, I love that. But I love when someone goes like, whoa, whoa, way off the reservation.
Well, I think the story was that, and I don't know if this is true or not, that there was supposed to be like a movie.
Yeah, they did a documentary. They did a behind the music.
Is that what
about
it was?
This fake guy?
But I think the idea was that it was supposed to be a movie.
Here it is, Chris Gaines.
And then like this was supposed to be like the soundtrack. But I think if there was a mistake, and I'm not going to try to discuss
Garth Brooks' such a nice guy, Chris.
Career
You're
in the realm of nice making guy. Mistakes. Well, you know, who am I to judge anybody on what they do? You know,
I mean,
particularly somebody who is as successful as he is. But
I love I Got Friends in Low Places.
Yeah,
I love a lot of Garth's music. I'm not a Garth Brooks hater. I think that was just a colossal fuck-up that I think is hilarious. And if Garth was here, I'd pull that up.
Okay.
And I would tell him I loved him.
All right.
And I would say, come on, dude, what the fuck were you smoking back then? Like, who talked you into this?
Well, I will say, I think at the time that he did that, he had to be into what in the world else can I do? The only way I can become more successful is if I become someone else and make them successful.
Yeah.
Like he was so successful and still is in that space that he can't be any bigger than he is.
Like Stephen King when he used to write as Richard Bachman. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I'm not aware of this.
Yeah, he wrote a bunch of books under a pseudonym because he was so gigantic that he decided to write some books under a different name so that people would sort of appreciate the work for what it was instead of as a Stephen King book, I think, or just maybe even as an exercise.
Right. Well, I think very much that's what it is. You know, I would look at it very much the same way. Of course, it's kind of hard when it's your face up there.
He should have put a mask on.
Yeah, something.
Should have got like Rick Baker to do him up with a fake nose. You know,
completely, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Make him like an ugly, weathered-looking, you know, saddle-worn dude.
Put a Sia wig on.
Yeah.
Just go.
Yeah. But it was, they had a behind-the-music story on his life story and the drugs and all the problems and the moodiness and, you know, but the music was always there. And, like, it's a hilarious behind the music. You could watch it on YouTube. I highly recommend it.
Okay. Well, I will watch it on YouTube. I haven't seen that particular thing.
But he's pulled himself out of that. He had a giant long hiatus. And here's an interesting thing about Garth Brooks. You can't get his shit on iTunes.
Oh, no. You have to get it on whatever his
CD or whatever.
And there's also his personally. He had something called Ghost Tunes for a minute, I think. Was that the name of it?
Mm.
It was like his own curated streaming service where you stream only Garth Brooks tunes or something like that. I don't know. I remember something about that.
Well, I think his idea is that he wants his albums played from, there it is, Ghost Tunes. He wants his albums played from the first song to the last. He doesn't want like little bits and chunks. He doesn't want to sell his songs individually. This is what I believe I've read, that he thinks of his albums as like one continuous work.
And I, as much as anybody, can understand that and want, you know, very much people to listen to things as bodies of work. But in the world we're living in, you know, sometimes you got to let people, you know, skip over a song here and there.
Let people do whatever they want with it. I mean, you did it as an individual. Yeah.
I don't want to control people's thing.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just a song that gets them. And that song, if you sell that song individually, that'll get them. And then maybe they'll check, all right, I'm listening to this 100 times. What else has Chris got to say?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
So how did you get, quote-unquote, discovered as a singer? You started off as a songwriter, but you were always singing.
I was always singing. I was in bluegrass bands. I was in rock bands. Always kind of touring, you know, in a pickup truck or something like that, you know.
How old are you?
I'm 39.
And how many years did you do that for?
I moved to Nashville when I was 23. And probably the first 3 years I was in town, I only wrote three times a day, living, eating, sleeping, breathing, songwriting. Trying to learn how to do that, you know, in a way that kept me a job at a publishing company. So
how does that work when you get signed by a publishing company or you get a job at a publishing company writing?
Well, you have, you know, you're a contract labor deal, basically. It's like you have, you sign a deal with, you know, like you get a year and they get an option or two to pick you back up for another couple of years, you know.
If one of those songs hits?
You know, those terms are worked out, whether you have what percentage of publishing they have and what percentage you have, and they pay you a salary in exchange for, you know.
Is it lucrative?
It can be, yeah. It can be if you have a bunch of songs on the radio.
And so for you, it was you were getting by doing this?
Well, I know I made a very comfortable living up to the point, you know, and I've for about, and what that allowed me to go out and play bluegrass for next to no money, or right. you know, play rock and roll and have fun doing it, and not worry about that being how I'm making a living, you know. But I got to do it for the right reasons,
right?
And so, in a lot of ways, you know, the songwriting thing, the commerce paid for the art, I guess, in that, which I am a firm believer in. And some people will argue this is a conversation that Sturgill and I will have, the commerce paying for the art.
So. Yeah,
but yeah, so yeah, it. It was. It's a great thing. It still is. I still write songs for people. I still write with people when they ask me to do that, because it's cool to get in somebody else's head, you know, or kind of sit down with them and try to help them realize some vision of what it is they want to do. And I that's still one of my favorite things to do. And I'm just as interested in that as I am in doing my own thing a lot.
Wow. So when you learn how to write music, did you when you would write? Well, do you sit down with an idea in mind with a guitar? Do you sit down with a pen and pad? Like, how do you write songs?
Well, if I'm writing by myself or with somebody,
by yourself,
because there's a lot of different processes. It can be, you know, whatever comes up that day. For me, generally, if I was just going to say, "Hey, I'm going to sit down and go over in that corner and write a song," I'd have a guitar. I'd probably have a legal pad and a pen, much like we have sitting right here, and I'd start strumming until that felt like something. And how does that make me feel? I don't know. I'd start humming a melody, maybe, and hopefully somewhere in humming the melody, a word would pop out that, or a noise I would make would turn into a word, and from there you can kind of grow this thing into whatever it is supposed to be. Now that's how I would do it if I was sitting around by myself. Now there's other times you and I could be having a conversation, and you could say a phrase or a line, or I could read a sign going down the road. You know, if you're a songwriter, you're always writing songs.
Right.
It's not like a choice that you have. It's like an affliction that you have in some way. So you're just kind of walking around unconsciously. Things will hit you, you know, or moments will hit you, or a visual will hit you, and that will spark something. So that's really it can come from anywhere, and that's the truth.
It sounds a lot like writing comedy.
I'm sure I personally cannot write comedy, but I would think the creative process is very much the same. You know, you're trying to kind of take life and distill it into something, you know, that evokes an emotional response.
Do you sometimes sit down with a blank slate, like you have no idea what you want to talk about or write about?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, back to the publishing deal thing, that was my job. Like, we would set appointments. We'd come in at noon and I have an appointment with writer ABC, you know, mm-hmm. and we sit down and try to come up with something.
Wow. That's got to be weird when you first work with someone for the first time.
It's a lot of first dates. It's a lot of first dates. But, you know, you find out pretty quickly how you can just kind of particularly when you write with writers who do that a lot, you can very much walk into a room and kind of throw all the, you know, "Oh, how's you doing?" All that kind of things. You just get down to it. You just be like, dive into it and start working on something. "Hey, this is on my mind. What do you think of this?" "No, that sucks." Let's, you know, and you have to be not nice a little bit to each other.
Right.
And you have to, and even if you don't know each other well, you have to act like you do in order to get to a spot where a song can be something.
Mm. And do you ever write with no guitar or no music? Do you ever just
absolutely. There's a song that I wrote on the Traveler record that we had a couple records back. Traveler, I wrote driving down the road, you know, driving down through the desert on Interstate 40. You know, wrote the whole thing driving, and then I had to go figure out how to play it.
Wow. So as you were driving, did you record it?
I had a phone. This is, you know, I just turned the voice recorder on. And,
right.
You know, I'm humming the phone and trying to, you know, my wife was asleep in the seat next to me, so I'm trying not to wake my wife up. I'm being real quiet.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, and then you get it done and you put it away and you go listen to it later and see what happens.
Wow. So in all these years, how many songs do you think you've written?
In excess of 1,000, probably.
Wow.
Somewhere like that.
Do you have stacks of them, like, laying around somewhere?
I mean, they're all cataloged, at the publishing company I write for, you know, and they're all, you know, you know, accounted for the most part, and I can kind of go back through them and dig in them if I need to.
Would you do that, like, for an album? Do you think
that's what I've been doing? Yeah, yeah. All the, you know, this record we're putting out and the last record that we have out, save for a few covers, they're all songs that are, you know, a decade old or something.
Wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
So Might As Well Get Stoned. How long is that one?
Oh God, that song is. It's probably one of the first songs I wrote when I moved to town. So I was probably 25 when I wrote that. So. Yeah, it's 13 years old, something like that.
Dude, love that song. I love all your songs, man. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
So when you are touring now, are you bringing your own opening acts with you? Are you deciding who comes out with you?
Yeah, well, we try to pick people that we know and love and we think, you know, fit musically, or we just want to support, you know.
Right.
And you have a lot of great people out on the road with us. We have Brent Cobb and Margo Price and Anderson East and Marty Stewart. Just, you know, there's a lot of people that we love. Have you listened to Brent Cobb or Anderson East?
Those no, guys? Yeah. No, I'm going to write this down afterwards.
Yeah, you, it's
give me some suggestions.
Yeah, you'll dig it. It's good stuff.
Well, birds of a feather flock together, and I know you type of dudes probably only like other legit type of people. So I could probably get some good data.
Well, I guess, yeah. No, we love music, and we like to support.
There's something about the art form of music that has always been very inspirational to me, and I've always drawn upon it for, like, you know that Hunter S. Thompson quote about music being fuel. You ever seen that quote?
I'm not sure.
See if you can pull it. It's on my Instagram page from pretty recently. When I was listening to Gary Clark Jr. just a couple of days ago.
Dude, that guy can play.
Fuck.
that guy's a freak.
He was with Honey Honey.
In the best way.
Yeah, and they did a version of Midnight Rider. Mm-hmm. Yeah, here, music has always been a matter of energy to me, a question of fuel. Sentimental people call it inspiration, but what they really mean is fuel. I've always needed fuel. I'm a serious consumer. On some nights, I still believe that a car with the gas needle on empty can run about 50 more miles if you have the right music very loud on the radio.
I like it. I like music in the car myself.
That's yeah, it. It's uniquely inspirational, like very few things. And the art of music and music creation is such a, I think when it's done correctly, I should say, it's a very pure art form, in the sense that the people that are doing it are really like digging into their creative engines and, you know, just getting the gears turning and pulling these things out. And it represents like however much burden you have in your personality, in your life, and you're like, that can either help you or hurt you in this process. And some people's music sort of represents the torment of their life, and some people's music represents the purity of their vision, but it's all has different effects on people in some sort of strange and bizarre way.
Yeah, I like to say that, you know, the songs, I was talking about the, I forget what I was talking about this, but I like songs that allow you to take ownership of them and make them personal to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I like listening. And I think that's probably what we all like about songs eventually, is our ability to relate to them. But also they become like I can write a song and I can play a song on a stage, but it doesn't really mean anything until somebody listens to it. And then their, you know, perception of what that song is about in relation to them comes back at us, you know, on a stage, or it lives in the world that way, and that's so cool to me. That's the thing that makes a song complete. I don't feel like they're even done until somebody listens to it and attaches to it.
Right.
That's the thing that I love so much about songs.
Yeah, and everybody's thing is different too, right? It's like, you can have two songs that are the exact same song, but they're sung by different people, and they have a completely different feeling. Like certain covers, you listen to certain covers, you're just like, whoa. It just hits you in a totally
absolutely.
Different way.
Yeah, absolutely. But and then the other side of that is, you know, two different people can listen to the same version of a song, and it means totally different things to them.
Yeah.
Because they attach the pieces of their life to it in a way that is unique to them. And that's the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, it's interactive in some sort of a weird way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And if it's not, it's nothing exists.
What I mean by, like, sometimes people's music represents sort of the torment that's going on in their own personal... what I was thinking specifically of was Amy Winehouse. Like, I was a big Amy Winehouse fan, and there's something about
that. She was great.
Fucking phenomenal. And something about that Rehab song, because she put that Rehab song out when everyone knew she was a mess.
Right.
And then she still, you know, like, they try to make me go to rehab. Said no.
She made it sound happy. No.
Yeah. She's like, fuck it, I'm riding this thing right into the beach.
Right.
I'm not stopping for the rocks.
Right.
I'm hitting the throttle. We're going to see where this goes.
It was tragic, but it produced some phenomenal music, no doubt.
Yeah, there was something to it. There was, like, almost a fatalistic acceptance of her own fate or something. Like,
well, and we can listen to it in that perspective now that she's not with us anymore. But, you know, at the time, it was a lot of teenage angst.
Almost celebratory.
Yeah, it felt celebratory at the time. On the other side of the tragedy of it, it has a little more weight, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, man, if you stop and think about how many tortured souls put out unbelievable music.
Oh, I think it's, you know, to some degree, some of the greats, you know, it's almost like a requirement that they are a little bit out there.
Yeah.
You know, and so, which is it's a horrible thing for them, but it's a beautiful thing for the rest of us who get to listen to it.
Yeah, right? Man, it's just the... just to be an artist in any form, right, requires all this vulnerability and just trying to find whatever it is when you're trying to create something. Where is that coming from? The ether, the muse. It's trying to just find that thing. And then when you're dealing with your own personal demons, like especially the deep drug demons, seem to produce some of the most insane music ever. You know, you think of Hendrix and Kurt Cobain.
Absolutely.
And you keep going down that list forever, really.
Yeah. And I have a songwriter friend who is convinced that you can't really produce something that is, you know, really noteworthy unless you have some kind of an addiction issue. So,
really?
Yeah. But I don't know if that's true, but, you know, if you're saying that very thing, you know, like you look back at, you know, history of rock and roll and music in general, you know, there's a lot of heavy drugs and a lot of, you know, getting out there on the edge that has, in fact, produced some of the greatest music that we've ever heard.
You also can hear it in the music. Like Stevie Ray Vaughan's a great example. You, like, hear the getting out there on the edge in the music.
Absolutely. You hear it with every ounce of everything in it.
Yeah, it's like there's no safety net in that kind of music. It's just all raw.
Yep. Absolutely.
You've got a crazy life, man. It's a crazy way to make a living.
It is a crazy way to make a living.
You must be super happy.
Well, I don't have any of those issues. I don't know what you're talking
about. I know, but you don't have to have any of those issues. I don't think that you have to have an addiction issue to be great. I just think you just have to pursue it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, maybe the addiction. I mean, there can be healthy addictions.
Mm-hmm.
I think,
that's true.
I think everybody.
That's a good way to look at it.
Most people that I meet that are successful in one way or another, they have, at the very least, kind of obsessive tendencies about something.
Right.
Whether, and generally it's some part of the work, but it's and focus. I see a lot of focus, like this kind of super focused thing that when you see certain people, you're like, oh, that's why he can do that.
Yeah.
It's 'cause or she can do that, that they have this ability to focus.
Yeah, there's a, I've always been amazed, too, when someone can take an instrument and make that instrument sound very specific to them. Like, Gary Clark Jr. is another good example of that. Like, see if you can find that video that I put up on my Instagram way back when with Honey Honey. Honey Honey and Gary Clark Jr. performed this really tiny place in downtown L.A. about maybe a year ago. And they did a midnight set on, like, a Wednesday night or some shit. And Gary Clark is up there doing the Allman Brothers Midnight Rider. Like, listen to this. And it's... That's him. You know what I'm saying? Like, that sound? That's him.
Yeah.
Come on.
He's mean, man.
That's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Like, that is him.
Well, that is him, but it's also everybody that's before him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that, and he's probably the one guy that we have in modern times that really can carry that torch, you know,
yes.
For the blues and you know, all those great, you know, great guitar players that we don't have a lot of them left, you know, like, I mean, he can do that, and that's real kind of, you know, B.B. King approach, you know, just playing some real straight line stuff. But then he can do Hendrix and all, you know, be crazy and psychedelic too. He can do any of that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that guy shines. And when you step on a stage with him, you know, it's we played he and I and Bonnie Raitt played a B.B. King tribute on the Grammys a few years back, and that was intimidating because, you know, and, you know, Bonnie Raitt's excellent in her own way. You know, like she has that thing just like he has, where it's just like those people are, they're special people.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And there's something about them that, like what Hunter was saying, that they're fuel. Like, I saw that and I ran home and I wrote for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
So I just was pumped up. I just felt like, I'd seen something, you know, I touched some new dimension.
You listen to a lot of Freddie King? You ever listen to Freddie King?
No.
Oh, no, man.
You got to write this down, too. I'm going to start writing down.
You got to get on Freddie King.
Freddie King. What kind of shit is he?
He's blues.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah?
He's not with us anymore, but,
oh,
you know, there's B.B. King, Albert King, and Freddie King. And
I've never heard of Freddie.
Oh, well, you've probably, you ever seen that show, Eastbound and Down?
Yeah.
You know, the theme song at the front of that?
Yeah.
That's Freddie King.
Oh, okay.
But there's
I love Freddie King.
there's a wealth of fuel if you want some.
Yeah.
In Freddie King. That's a pretty, standard staple of listening for me. If I want to turn something on and let it make me feel right, Freddie King.
I got a John Lee Hooker problem. When I start thinking about blues, I just listen to John Lee Hooker. I have so much John Lee Hooker on my phone. I have no room for other people.
Oh, you got to get some Freddie King in there.
All right, I'll get some Freddie King in there. But when I'm tired and I don't feel like working out, I put Boom 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 on.
All right,
and woo, here we go. We're off to the races. It's just something about those types of songs, you know, that deep blues. It's just got this extra special soul to it. You know, there's just sort of immersed in the feeling of those people, you know?
Yeah, it's heavy-duty stuff, man.
Music is heavy-duty stuff, man. How fortunate do you feel?
Oh, I'm the luckiest man in the world. I say that all the time, and it's true. I am absolutely the luckiest dude in the world.
I would imagine you feel that way. Yeah, I mean, you found
your
thing.
No, it's actually true.
I think I'm the luckiest guy in the world, but I'll let you slide.
All right.
Because you're here.
Well, I'm top five. I'm top five.
I think we're all the luckiest person in the world if you actually found your thing that you like to do.
Yeah.
And you don't really – you work, but you don't really work.
Well, yeah. It's, I mean, listen, I do a lot. We do a lot.
It's work.
It's work in the sense of it's time consuming.
Yes. It requires effort and focus.
But listen, there's nothing else I would rather do for a living, and I'm grateful and thankful every day for it, and because I love it.
Well, you could tell. I mean, it really comes out in your music. You really could tell. It's pure. Do you listen to any classical?
Any classical music?
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I used to listen to more classical music than I do now. But, I enjoy occasionally going to the symphony, you know. But I haven't gone in years. But I do like that music. It moves me in a different kind of way than listening to Freddie King would. But
all right, here's the big question. Jazz.
Jazz. I do like jazz music. Not necessarily like super experimental jazz music that gets way, way out there, like acid jazz.
You know? like Coltrane, like,
yeah,
classic,
you know,
stuff.
Well, I just, yeah. And once again, I am not in no way am I an authority on jazz. But if it's on, I will enjoy it. Because I enjoy, as a musician, I enjoy, just like I enjoy great blues players. There's so many great musicians in jazz. Like, I had an opportunity to write some songs. Dan Wilson called me up one time to go write some songs with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. And so we wrote some songs I knew nothing about New Orleans jazz whatsoever. But I went down to New Orleans and I participated in this and wrote these songs that now live in the jazz world. So that really is thrilling to me to get to that thing I was telling you about where I get to go hop into somebody else's space and see if I'm helpful. You know, that's cool to me, you know. And so now I have, you know, I have that it feels like a – to me, like that's a feather in my cap. I got to go participate with those guys, and they're so great, every one of them.
I have some friends that love that sort of collaboration thing, too, whether it's in music. I have a good buddy of mine who writes a lot for – my friend Tony Hinchcliffe writes a lot for people for roasts, and he does punch-up on shows and things along those lines. But he relishes that opportunity. He likes collaborating, likes helping people out on stuff.
Yeah. Well, and it just gives you the opportunity to flex your mind in a way that maybe you wouldn't.
Yeah,
in your own space, you know.
Right. What do you do when you're not doing music?
That's all I do, pretty much.
Really?
I play music, and I like to. I have things I like to do. I like to fish.
Me
but
too.
But I don't get to do that a whole lot.
Bass fish? What do you do?
I grew up on a trout stream.
Oh yeah. Where?
I'm not a fly fisher in Kentucky. But I'm not a fly fisherman. But you know,
spinning tackle.
Yeah, just spinning tackle. I used to use a little. Just ultralight spinning rig. My summers were spent as a kid. I'd be in the creek at 5:30. You know,
my friend Steve Rinella was just talking to a famous writer recently in his last podcast. I don't remember the man's name, but he's famous in the fishing writing world, and he's a fly fisherman. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he had a really interesting question. He said, "Why is so much great literature attached to fly fishing, but not to spin tackle?" And it's
that's
true.
That's a good question, and I think. I don't know, it's kind of like using spin tackles like this workman. It's like a blue collar way of doing it, or that's my perception of it. Mm-hmm. And then people who are fly fishermen, and I've seen these guys in action, you know, use a fly rod. There's an art to it, but there's an art to using all of it. But the guys who are fly fishermen take a lot more pride in the art of it.
Yeah,
and please forgive me, fishermen out there, if I'm misrepresenting anybody who likes to do either of these things. But my perception of it is, you know, guys with a spin reel, and then me, I just want to catch the fish.
Right, right.
I'm not, you know, if it means I'm flipping it out there, if it means I'm tossing it, if it means I'm jig fishing with it, doesn't matter. I want to figure out the way to catch the fish. The fly fishermen, they like the process.
Yeah, I started out with a spinning rod. I actually started out with one of the Zebco push button spin cast jammies.
Yeah.
And then I went to bait casting reel and then for bass. And then when I got into trout fishing, I eventually moved on to fly fishing and I learned how to tie some flies.
So you're serious about it. So I'm sitting here talking about your.
No.
That's your hobby.
It's been a long time. Now when I fish, I fish maybe once a year, like on vacation.
Yeah, that's basically when it happens for me is I charter a guy on a boat somewhere.
Yeah.
To go.
It's fun.
Which is easy. It's fun, yeah.
Well, I've done it in Hawaii and Mexico, and the great thing is, like, say if you're staying at a resort, either like you could rent a boat, they'll take you out, you catch a tuna or something like that, and then you cook it and eat it for lunch, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
like you're
no, that's great.
Yeah. That's about the extent of my fishing these days.
Yeah.
My other outdoor activities have sort of overwhelmed my fishing time. But there's something about the people that get into fly fishing that it's not just fishing. One of the weird things about fly fishing is a lot of them let the fish go. There's a lot of catch and release going on with fly fishing.
I like that too. I mean, I used to let a lot of them go.
I get that, but I'm a little tormented on that. You're putting a fucking hook through something's head and you're gonna let it go. Like, how about just not doing that if you really love the fish? How about just fish with no hook at all? When they bite it, you know you would have had them.
That's probably fair.
Yeah, it's probably the way to go. It's weird that it's this weird thing that we have in our head where we're trying to activate those reward systems that were there in place in order to keep ourselves fed. Right? Like, if there's a thing that happens when you catch a fish, you've seen, like I've seen with my little kids, I've taken my daughters fishing, and when they catch a fish, they have this look on their face like, oh, I got it. Oh, yeah. Like, this is super exciting when they pull it out of the boat, and then the fact that they're going to get to eat it later, there's some weird primal DNA thing that gets activated when you catch something. And I think that's what these fly fishermen that are letting the fish go are trying to do. They're just little junkies for that
feeling.
That feeling, that DNA activation, reward system thing. And obviously it's difficult, and obviously there's a lot of tremendous amount of skill and finesse involved in fly casting and roll casting and trying to place this fly right in this little pool and drag it with the current and get that nasty trout to bite onto it. But you also want to own it. You want to have him and let him go. Like, you don't want to like say, I could have had you, but there's no hook on that.
The dark side of fly fishing.
Yeah. You want to know you got it. You don't want to know he bit. You want to know you got it. So no one goes fly fishing with no hook. They go with a barbless hook, and they'll catch it, and then they'll let it go, and they'll say, oh, it's fine. It's a barbless hook. Like, okay. How about I put a barbless hook through your fucking face? Like, that shit ain't good. That's not good.
You're trying to ruin fishing for all catch and release fishermen.
I am not. And I support it 100%, and I've done it. I'm a hypocrite in that regard. I have done some catch and release. But I feel like there is a weirdness to it that it's this why.
Yeah.
You're not eating it. Like, why? Like, how about you can't just look at them? No. You got to catch them. Got to catch them and have them and then let them go.
But how are you going to look at them if you don't catch
them? Look at them in the water. Here's the thing. A good percentage, I don't know what the number is, especially when you're like salmon fishing and you're using like heavy tackle, a good percentage of your catch and release into those fish are never going to make it. You catch them with a big lure, barbed hooks, you get them deep in the throat, you pull them out, their gills are bleeding, let them go.
I mean, That's a scenario that you don't like.
Yeah.
And in that instance, most fishermen, I think, would know that you can't turn that fish back loose.
But you have to sometimes.
Well, you do have to sometimes.
Yeah.
But
you have to turn them loose because it's the law, it's the regulations, and you turn it loose and you watch it swim away. You're like, this motherfucker's got about a 40% chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and everybody hates that.
Yeah. It's the worst.
But they still want that feeling.
The catching the fish thing's a weird feeling. Apparently, that's that way with butterfly catchers, too, because human beings used to be insectivores.
Really?
Yeah, I was listening to this lecture once by Terrence McKenna, and he was talking about that. Terrence McKenna, the great psychedelic author and lecturer, he was talking about how he was really into butterfly catching at one point in time. And the odd thing is that it activates this very primal reward system in your body the same way catching a fish would. That it's like, because human beings used to be insectivores. We used to eat a lot of insects. Huh. So when you do find some rare butterfly that you've been after for months and months, and you have the opportunity to drop the net on that motherfucker, I got him. Get so excited about him. That's a weird sort of trophy hunting, butterfly hunting, too. Because you're allowed to do that. You could take that little fucker, dry him out, and put him on a wall somewhere, and nobody thinks you're a barbarian. Like, people are real racist when it comes to what animals are allowed to be dead. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Pigs and cows are screwed.
Yeah. Remember. Yeah, pigs and cows. Well, I mean, but more so bugs, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, nobody likes bugs. Like, butterflies, sort of.
I went to an ashram once, and this lady who was running the ashram had a can of Raid, and she was talking to me about the ant problem that they have. And I was like, hold up. So you spray these ants with poison? And she's like, yeah. And I go, so you kill the ants. I go, isn't that contrary to what you're teaching? She's like, sometimes there's just things you have to do because otherwise the ants will get in our food. And oh, okay. I was like, huh. This is odd. You're in an odd crossroads here, lady.
Yeah.
You're a Buddhist living in an ashram with a can of poison that you use for living beings that you don't like being around you.
I have nothing.
I don't know. It's fine. But if she was like, if she had like cats that she was killing with a baseball bat, everybody would be mad.
Oh, she'd be in jail.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Yeah.
We have weird rules. Sorry to take you down this road.
No, this is very interesting to me. I didn't know that human beings used to be insectivores. So.
Yeah, apparently.
Learn something new every day.
Well, that's one of the things that they talk about in terms of the future of protein, that insects provide very complex, complete proteins, and they can provide it to large amounts of people fairly inexpensively. And so cricket protein is very popular today. I don't know if you know this.
No.
A lot of people eat cricket protein.
Hmm.
Yeah, they have cricket bars and shit.
Cricket bars?
Yeah, they make bars out of crickets. Yeah, cricket protein bars. Hmm. And apparently they taste pretty good.
Well, you know, my daughter ate, we bought, like, on vacation somewhere, like, this novelty sack of, like, barbecue crickets or something because the kids wanted to try them. Of course, my son was like, after he actually got it out of the package, he was like, I don't know about that. My daughter's like, I'll try it. And she ate it. And then she was like, it's pretty good.
They're not bad. So, what is this, a cricket milkshake? Hey. Yeah, is that pre-made? There's the cricket bars.
It's from the powder.
I think it would look more palatable if they didn't have a picture of a cricket, like, crawling out of it.
Yeah, hide that shit. So there's the cricket protein powder. They cook the cricket, grind those little fuckers up, and turn it into protein powder. And it apparently has a complete amino acid profile. It's easy to digest, and it doesn't make people feel bad. Like, look at that. That's look at the grams of protein per 100 gallons of water, how much you can get. For a cow, you only get 6 grams of protein for 100 grams of water, or 100 gallons of water. But for crickets, you get 71 grams of protein for the same amount of water.
Wow.
So it's more than 10 times the amount of protein. So you could – and I don't think it has near the impact on the environment in terms of, like, raising them. They don't have, like, a lot of the waste products and the issues that cows have, methane. Smells.
This is amazing.
Sorry, dude. Let's go back to music.
No, it's all good. I'm sitting here thinking about eating crickets. I'm thinking about switching.
I've had crickets before, man. I was in Mexico, and they cooked them and left them in the room. Like, we stayed at a hotel.
Like just a little snack.
Yeah, like a little snack thing. It was a little, they were like almost like a soy sauce based or some sort of a salt based.
Like their chips or something.
Yeah, and they were fried. And you just crunch them, and I was like, okay, these are actually pretty good. They're like, they're essentially related, but a lot of bugs are related to shellfish.
Hmm.
Whereas, like, we found on Fear Factor that if you're allergic to shrimp, you're also allergic to roaches.
Really?
Yeah, we found that out because we made a dude eat roaches,
and he started having an allergic reaction.
They had to get him a shot of adrenaline and take him to the hospital.
That's awful.
Yeah.
That was a bad day.
Yeah, you know, I guess your throat closes up on you and you start, you know, a lot of inflammation. You start wheezing.
Yeah, it's not fun.
Yeah, but crickets, good and high in protein. You never eat anything weird? Are you like a straight-laced eater?
I'm pretty straight.
Wild game?
My dad was a bird hunter and a rabbit hunter growing up, but okay. I never loved it.
No?
No.
It's all about how it's cooked, really, right?
Yeah, and I don't know if we ever got that down at my house. So
yeah, it's tricky. Like, I think if you're around a real wild game chef, like there's a guy named Hank Shaw who's been on this podcast before, who is a hunter who's also like a real extraordinary chef, and he makes these amazing dishes with wild game. And he's one of those guys who's like, you know, you think it's bad because you haven't cooked it right. Let me cook it.
Yeah, I think there's a lost art to some of it, or a lesser known art, maybe. I don't know.
Where are you living right now, man?
I live south of Nashville, Tennessee.
So when you flew into hell today and you see, like, literally, it's on fire. For people listening at this point in time, this is one of the worst fires in the history of Los Angeles.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah, because it's what's called a dry hurricane, meaning there's hurricane-force winds, but there's no rain, and the fires are going fucking crazy. 50,000 acres down in a day is nothing right now.
Yeah, it's we've been here a few days, and we were – we got in 2 or 3 days ago, and we've been doing some other things, TV things, whatever. But waking up to that on the news is not a fun thing to watch, and I'm so heartbroken for everybody losing their homes, and it's pretty tragic, awful thing to have to watch.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, it's the side effect of living in a place that doesn't have any weather. You know,
there you go.
Everything dries out. It so rarely rains here. You know, and when you get like these crazy winds, the Santa Ana winds that happen every year, this is extraordinary, the winds here, and it's just perfect time for fires, obviously.
So is somebody kicking these things up, or what's the deal, really?
No one knows. Yeah. No one. It could be arson. Yeah. It could be, you know.
It feels like that.
Could be. Look, there's some sick fucks out there. They know that the wind is a bad thing for fire, and then all of a sudden a fire shows up. It's entirely possible that out of 20 million people, there's one or two people that are out of their fucking mind.
Well, that's way out there.
But is that what you were thinking?
I don't know. I just watch it. I'm just like, I mean, how does the fire spontaneously start? You know that.
Yeah.
And these, I don't know. It just seems.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, that's one of the suspicions is that it's arson related, or this several fires.
Right.
One of them.
That's
could
what I'm saying.
Be.
There's so many going at this point. I'm just like, is somebody running around like thinking. I don't know what
well,
they
that's
get
the
off
thing.
On it or whatever.
Yeah, they happen simultaneously, all during the same crazy conditions, and they happen like way far apart from each other. So you talk to firefighters about it, and they're like, there's a lot of times we don't know, but there's a lot of times some serious suspicions.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's unfortunate that you would have to think about that. I mean, think about all these human beings, and there's one or two or however, whatever the number is, that are so tortured and so in pain and so fucked up. Their wires
just want
are
to burn
so crossed.
Something down. Yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Of course.
And I hope that's not the case. But I watch all these guys on the news, you know, up on the roofs trying to save their property or, you know, firefighters putting themselves in harm's way or guys flying helicopters dumping water in zero visibility conditions. And it's just like, man, it's awful.
It is awful. You know, it's around this time of year you really appreciate firefighters.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people take them for granted most of the time until you need them. They're like, they're superheroes that only get credit when they do some shit.
Right.
You know, and when they do some shit, you realize like, oh, without them, like I talked to a firefighter once, it freaked me the fuck out. He was saying, it's just a matter of time till one day with the right winds, there's a fire that burns all the way to the ocean, just goes right through LA and there's nothing we can do about it. And I was like, what? He's like, it's a matter of time. He goes, everybody thinks it. It's just a matter of catching the right fire. And then you realize today, like, oh, he's right. Like,
oh, yeah.
Bel Air's on fire.
Yeah.
Where all the rich people live. That's on fire.
Yeah. No, it's, like I said, it's like live on the news. We were watching it in the hotel room. You know, it's just pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
We changed our route to get over here today just to get because there's road closures and things like that. You know,
did it take you more time?
I think we gave ourselves like an hour and 20 minutes, hour and a half to get over here today. So.
What else you got going on right now?
We did a few TV things and we're kind of winding down for the year and then we'll kick back up end of January. Got the Grammys in January, I guess. And then kind of slowly get back into it. But my wife's pregnant with twins, so we're trying to.
Oh wow!
To
congratulations!
Thank you. You know, have and she tours with and sings with me pretty much all the time, and so we're trying to figure out the new reality of that. You know, we have two kids out with us, but now we're going to four. So it's
how old are your kids?
They're 8 and 7.
So do you bring a tutor on the road with you? How do you do that?
My mother-in-law is a retired second grade school teacher. So,
convenient.
Yeah. So. So we homeschool our children on the road, and they get, you know, when they study the Boston Tea Party, they get to go look at all the stuff in Boston, you know.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, it's a different kind of education, but things like that kind of live and breathe for them a little bit more than what I got growing up, and hopefully someday they'll appreciate that.
Oh, I'm sure they will. I mean, it's got to be interesting to them, too, to see their dad go from being a singer-songwriter to all of a sudden being a celebrity singer. Have they realized that?
I don't know. I think to them they're young enough, and you know, that it just seems like mom and dad have to go sing a show. You know, like,
right? It's just what they do.
When are your mom and dad going to go sing? You know, like
my mom makes houses.
Yeah,
yeah. She doesn't sing. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have real. They don't have anything else to compare it to. So
right.
That's
point
just
of reference.
Just kind of normal. Yeah, point of reference. That's what I was looking for. So it's just kind of what life is to them.
When you tour, how long do you go? Like how much of a stretch?
Well, we very rarely try to. I mean, we try to be weekend warriors as much as we can and do, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday runs. But you know, some things logistically that doesn't make any sense. If you're going to run across Canada or we're, you know, based in Nashville, so if we want to run the West Coast, we're out here for a couple of weeks or something like that. But never longer than that. You know, we never try to stay out. We're not very rock and roll about it, and we don't live out there and don't want to, you know. So I love to play shows. There's a limit on how many I can sing in a week. It's 3's the limit. So we stick with that and try to make that have as much kind of home time and So all the guys in the band, the crew, and you know everybody's got kids and families and things, and it's a hard way to make a living if you're always gone, like months and months and months gone. Which that's the rock and roll way of doing things a lot.
Yeah, I know Sturgill had to do that for a while.
He didn't have to. He chose to.
Yeah,
I had to convince him of that. But
you had to convince him of that he didn't have to.
Yeah. He convinces himself of anything. I'm not going to say that I convinced
him. I know what you're saying, but influenced him.
Well, yeah. I'm not even going to say I influenced him, but I would tell him.
Suggested.
I would tell him, hey, man, you don't have to. Why are you doing this? You
know. Okay. Yeah. So he felt like what – I think all his years of working regular jobs, you know, working on the railroad and doing all the shit that he had to do, when success came, he was like, Jesus Christ, I got to keep this fire going.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and
– get the kindling, you know, chop wood.
Absolutely. You have this moment, you know, when you have a little something going on where you're like, well, I got to, you know, make hay while the sun's shining. And
yes.
I understand that wholeheartedly. But, you know, we're all human beings and we all have limits.
So, yeah. Do you have a limit of the amount of days that you could sing in a week?
Yeah, three.
That's it?
Yeah. That's it.
And then your voice starts to get strained?
Yeah. I sing pretty hard too, you know, so, that's the end. You know, and I have conversations with other singers when I run into them. It's like, how many shows can you play in a week? And you know, some guys it's two, and some guys it's like I can play every day of the week.
Wow.
But that's not me. Three shows is kind of the limit.
Do you ever have a greedy McMoney Bags agent that's like, listen, Chris, four shows a week, 25% more money. just one more show.
I wouldn't call anybody I work with greedy McMoney Bags.
Not going to hurt you, Christopher. Two shows a night, not a big deal.
But certainly everybody wants, as you work with, and that's their job, is to try to maximize what you're able to do monetarily. And you know, sometimes you just have to look at them and go, sorry, I can't do that.
So it's ultimately
not,
you're
not
the
physically,
captain.
Not physically possible.
Yeah.
And then they have to deal within those parameters, and we figure out how to maximize that.
Does every country music singer have to live around Nashville? Is that like requisite?
I don't.
It seems like it's a giant collection of you fuckers living in this one spot.
Well, I mean, that is the kind of the hub for, like actors living in L.A. or something.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Or New York, whatever, wherever the...
I think it's L.A.
If you want to be in a certain industry, it helps. You know, must win, must be present to win. You know,
like, yeah,
to some degree. You know,
do you feel that place has a certain energy to it as well, though?
It does have an energy to it, and it has had an energy to it, and it's a very changing energy at the moment. I don't live in Nashville proper anymore, but I did for years. But it's a different place, you know, and it's not just it's a music place, but there's so much else going on. There's 19 or 20 cranes building condos downtown. You know, it's
what's going on in Nashville.
They're just, I don't know. Everybody wants to buy a condo, I guess. I don't know. I don't understand it. But there's an influx of people who all of a sudden think it's a good idea to move to Nashville.
Yeah. Well, that's what I had heard. I'd heard that it's almost becoming like LA-ified.
A little bit. I don't know what that means, but if that means that there's a lot of condo building going on.
You see
on,
a lot of chicks with lips like this?
Duck lips. I'll be honest, I don't run around, and I go into Nashville when I have to go into Nashville for certain things.
For supplies.
Yeah, for supplies. And then I park myself out in the country.
So that's where you live? You live. That's nice. Got a spread?
Yeah, we have a little bit of land and
wildlife, animals.
Oh yeah, no, those bobcats and turkeys and
that's nice.
Deer, you name it.
Yeah, what I've heard about Nashville is that Nashville started out as sort of this pure sort of music environment, and then over time it became a money grab, and people realized that it's a music environment, and they said, "How do we capitalize on this?" And then people said, "Oh, I heard this is a music environment. I'm going to move there," and then it became like a place to be seen, and that it's still got the music there, but it's also like weirdly compromised. Does that make sense?
No more than anywhere else. I mean, I think.
Right. Is that human nature?
Man, I don't know. I don't want to say. It sounds very like anti, any corporate involvement of anything to say that it's been tainted or it's all a money grab or something. Mm.
I don't think it's all. I'm definitely not saying that. I love Nashville, by the way.
Okay, well, no, I do too. But I'm just trying to wrap my head around the relayed opinion of, or was that your opinion?
No, it's other people that I know, people that have lived there and then moved back.
Got you.
Yeah, just people that had this romantic notion of I want to go there and this is like sort of country-ish city where everybody's soulful, they're all singing songs, and it's just you go down and see all these amateur bands or these bands that are just starting out and they're amazing.
Yeah, I don't think that's really that's some kind of Mayberry version of what Nashville is. I mean, that's
Narnia.
Yeah, that's I think that's some kind of unicorn that you're inventing in your mind if you think that that's any town that you're going to, like that.
Right.
It's like I don't know what the equivalent would be, but feeling like you moved to some island somewhere and everybody walks around and has yachts and, you know, just drinks martinis all day or whatever. You know, it's just like that's not even true.
Well, there's like places that you're supposed to go to. Like when I was in Boston, when I first started out doing stand-up, I had heard about the Comedy Store. That was like the Mecca.
Right.
Like you had to get to the Comedy Store in Hollywood. Right. It was like spoken with hushed tones. And everybody sort of came to that place. It's like it drew everybody in from across the country. And from my friends like Honey and other people that I know that lived in Nashville for a while, that was Nashville was kind of that to them. It's like what it was is like this kind of place where you'd seen and heard so much amazing music has come out of that part of the world. And it's so music centered. You know, I mean, it has a different vibe because it's a very it's a very artistic city.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's also a side to it now, and it's been in the last five. And sorry, Nashville, if it feels like I'm talking about you, but it's there's a thing now where you go downtown, and it's more like you're going to a giant bachelorette party or something. You know, it's just like everybody's I don't know, just looking to drink their face off and listen to bad covers of. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sorry. I need to apologize.
No, it's okay. You're being honest.
But it's, you know, and it's great for the city in a lot of ways, tourism-wise and
right.
monetarily and all those things. But it also changes that whatever some notions of that romantic thing that you're talking about. Those things still exist, but they have to be, like a lot of things that have soul, they need to be sought out.
Right. Like the difference between a real old-school barbecue joint and TGI Fridays.
I have nothing against TGI Fridays, but
either.
I know what you mean.
I know what you mean, too. Yeah.
I see you laughing at me, like, backpedaling all the
No.
Potential.
I'm forcing you into this. I didn't mean to. I'm just talking about my point about it, all of it really is the idea of artistic integrity is a fleeting thing and a sacred thing and a critical thing for a guy like you to create the kind of music that you make. And I'm always interested, like, how someone cultivates that, how someone protects that, because I think it's what goes away. It's when things go off the rails, it's usually the focus away from the creative aspect of it, the art, the making the thing that you loved in the beginning when you got into this thing.
Right.
You know, and sometimes people get – it happens to comedians in a big way. They get – movies and they become famous and then they believe their own bullshit and they put out these specials that are terrible. It's real easy to fall into.
Sure. But there's also, you know, there's a side of that. I would argue that maybe that is what's in their heart at that moment. And that's just as real as anything else, you know?
Mm.
But
I would argue that they're in the wrong environment.
Well,
it's been surrounded by the wrong people with the wrong influences, and they have the wrong focus.
Okay. I'll go with that. But everybody's going to evolve in one way or another.
Yeah.
For better
bad.
Or worse,
right?
And everybody's going to have these high points and low points of where they really were in the zone, so to speak, or not in the zone.
Yeah,
creatively, I think that's just life. And,
yeah.
But I don't know. It's life for me. If there's a way to try to preserve some notion of integrity, it's just that thing I was saying earlier. It's just like if you let all the other stuff just put the blinders on and go, all right, here I am. Here are the guys that I play music with and the girls. we're going to sit in a room. What are we going to do? What would we do if none of this other stuff existed? And that's the way you keep it where it should be.
Right.
Is you keep it right in the moment and right in the room, and don't let some notion of trying to outdo yourself or outsell yourself or, you know, make more money than the other guy or have a number one over top of the other guy or, you know, because all that kind of stuff's manufactured too, like number ones. And,
right.
and those are just numbers that, and some of them are so tainted by people just doing things that manufacture that number that they want to have that it's not even a real thing at that point.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, I always felt weird about contests and things that, and any sort of like ranking system that involves art.
Okay. So you're way anti any kind of award.
Well, I just think that like the Oscars and the Grammys and all that kind of shit like that, like, I don't give a fuck who you think is great. I don't care who you think is the great at number one. Like the number, and the winner is, open the envelope. Oh my God, is he going to get it? Like the work is the work. The work is done. Like if it's Apocalypse Now is a great fucking movie. It doesn't matter what you give him a gold statue or not. Like what's the work? The work is great. Like for it to win a thing or not win a thing. You know, and some of the things that have won, you can tell that the win is tainted by the political climate, that the people are like leaning towards something that's socially aware and so somebody made a movie with lesbians that saved the planet from, you know what I mean? It's like that kind of shit becomes like transparent and obvious, and you can do that and rig the system and win an award. I think that awards for art are goofy. Awards for comedy are super, every comedy competition I've ever seen, they're super goofy. It's just, it's missing the whole idea of the thing. The whole idea of the thing is supposed to be the art. It's not supposed to be trying to win an award.
No, it's not. But, you know, if you win an award out of that and it allows you to make more art.
And it makes people pay attention to the art.
So be it.
Yeah. It's sort of a bastardization. That's always felt like about that. There was a show called Last Comic Standing. And the good thing about it was that it got a lot of comics that people hadn't heard of, and they put them on television and helped their career. But the bad thing was they're doing like a contest, and like, who's the audience? Clap for more. Do you want Mike? Yay! What about Debbie? Not too much. That's fucking weird. It's weird.
Okay. We have a lot of those shows.
Yes. There's not as many anymore. A lot of them are singing, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. People like to watch those shows.
Yeah.
Because people also like the idea that you can be one thing one minute, and one moment on television can make you some other totally different person.
People love that. Like, that's why Susan Boyle was so famous, right?
Yes.
We saw this woman. Everybody was doubting her. She goes out there, and she's got pipes, and she belts that song out, and you can see Simon, who's just a douchebag, was like, holy shit, she's amazing. Like, you could see it. Like, you're undeniable,
right?
You know?
But those are good moments, though.
Yes.
Those are good moments.
Those are the best moments. The other good moments are like when they have American Idol and they have those people that have no business being there and they play their auditions, too. Those are the other good moments for the wrong reasons, right?
Yes. But, you know, if you're watching that show, you're watching it for that, too.
Right. Is there a good show to introduce people to country music? Like, you know, there used to be, like, shows where people could... You know,
yeah, we used to have, you know, like Nashville Now and things like that. Like, I don't think that really exists anymore. Like a country music specific show.
Yeah.
No, I don't think we really have that anymore. Like a variety show, like Johnny Cash show or Glenn Campbell show or something like that. No, we don't have that anymore. And I don't know how much people want that anymore. You know, otherwise it might exist. But
oh, man, I think
if there's
the
right person
to
do it, you know, maybe there's not the right person to do it. I don't know.
I just think someone needs to make it. I feel like there's so much. What you're telling me about all these artists I got to go look into, and I'm sure there's a bunch that are coming up that are probably equally talented, and you know maybe they just need an opportunity like that, like something like along those lines, some sort of a show, a variety show where really talented people can come out and show their songs.
It'd be good. Well, the closest thing to that right now. Have you seen this Mike Judge show?
Mike Judge, the guy from King of the Hill?
It's
Beavis and Butthead?
Like Tales from the Tour Bus or something like
that? No, what is that?
He talks to all these old school like Texas country acts or like old, it's all these, all the folklore of country music and these, and he does it like interview style and they're all telling these stories.
And, play this trailer.
Oh, man.
I want to hear this.
It's phenomenal.
I love Mike Judge.
From the hillbilly with a hit record.
George Jones.
He had 36 brand new cars.
My favorite had a horn sound like a dying bull.
The wild Jerry Lee Lewis.
He bought a machine gun, shot up a demo lab. It was next door, $50,000 worth of false teeth.
I knew he was fixing to shoot, and I didn't want to be in the line of fire.
So they would tell stories, and then they'd animate them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is, but all these guys that you see animated, these are the real guys that lived a lot of these things
right.
and are telling these stories. This is, these are not made up characters or in any way. And I know some of the guys that wind up being animated on these things. And I have for years said, you know, if even half of the folklore that exists in country music could be told, it would be the biggest thing in the world, you know. And that's what he's doing right now with that show, and he's doing an excellent job of it. And it's really, for me, and maybe it's not as entertaining to other people, I don't know. But for me as a musician, knowing some of the folklore and knowing how many great characters and storytellers exist in country music and have existed, it's so refreshing to see these guys get stories told about them.
That's awesome. I didn't even know Mike Judge was a country music fan.
I didn't either, but I got to tell you, he's knocking it out of the park as far as I'm concerned with this TV show.
So
I hope
glad.
It does really well.
I'm so glad you brought this up. Yeah, it looks hilarious.
It's awesome. And I don't say that about much. I don't really like get super pumped up about a lot.
But do you watch other shit?
Yeah, you know, I like a lot of some pretty obvious things like Game of Thrones and
right.
Walking Dead. I'm into that. I like, you know, I like kind of science fiction based things, and you know, I like things that are done well, whatever it is. And I think both of those are done well.
So do you binge watch TV shows?
Absolutely. That's the only way I can watch a TV show, you know, because half the time I'm doing something when it actually comes on, you know.
Right, right, right. So when you look at yourself right now and you look at all this cool shit that you're doing, do you hope to just keep doing it this way? Do you have some grand plans?
We far surpassed any grand plan that I might have had like years ago. So I'm hopeful that we get to continue to do some cool things and have fun doing it. And, you know, I'm at that age where, you know, I'm just old enough not to be stupid with what we're doing and,
right.
and hopefully young enough to really get to keep doing it for a little while. And I don't know, man. I'm grateful for anything that we've gotten to do and we'll get to do in the future. And hopefully the next few years will just be a continuation of that.
That's all you could ask for, man. I mean, if you're what you're doing now is so awesome and so much fun.
Yeah, I can't imagine if I could like write a script for how, you know, this is how the curve of I want my career of putting records out to go. I couldn't write it any better for me, you know, and I get to do, I have freedom to do basically whatever I want and play however I want and sing about whatever I want and that's it's the greatest thing in the world.
Do you get young guys coming up to you, young girls coming up to you that have dreams of being a singer, songwriter?
And sure.
Ask you for advice?
Yeah, and my advice is always just be nice, you know.
Be nice.
Be nice, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, well, I think that's, you know, I think that's always easier than making too many enemies or, you know. And, you know, you inevitably have people that don't believe in what you do or things. That's just,
right.
That's all that subjective thing. You know?
Of course. Yeah.
But, yeah, being nice is important, but also being you. Be you and be nice, you know. And if you do those two things, I think that's the best recipe to hopefully for you to put yourself in the position to get lucky.
Is this something that you had to figure out yourself?
Yeah. I mean, when you start, and I don't know how it works from your end, what you do, when you start and when you get your first little, you know, I get a publishing deal and you get to be around some of – what an industry is. And then you slowly but surely get to meet people who are successful in different facets of it. And I think what I find is the people that I gravitate towards and that I really respect and look at and go, hey, a career like that would be nice. You know, they're very nice, you know, caring, giving individuals who support younger artists, and they, you know, they do nice things for their communities, and they do nice things for people out in the world, and they make music that's in their heart, and those are the things that I think are good to aspire to as a musician, and those are the things that I respect. I respect that,
yeah,
a whole lot.
Not just talented, but nice.
Yeah,
yeah. Now, what about, like, work ethic? Or do you have people asking you questions about, like, how do you motivate yourself, or how do you sit down and write? How do you, like, what's your process?
What is my advice to them?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I say, write as much as you can with as many people as you can find who know what they're doing. And that's how you learn how to write songs. But, I'll also say, I used to have a songwriter friend who said, you can't learn how to be a songwriter. You can learn how to write better songs more often. But it's not, you know, it's like, and I'm, forgive me if this is a wrong analogy, but I don't think you can really learn how to be funny if you're a comedian.
I used to think that. Because I used to think, well, you're either funny or not funny. And then I realized, like, oh, some people need to learn how to be comfortable enough to be funny.
You think?
And yeah. I've met people that sucked, and then they got good.
Really?
Like,
well,
really good.
Well, I'm giving the wrong advice then, because I personally think, like, some of it has to be innate, and then you have to learn how to sharpen that tool a little bit.
Well, I think whoever you are can change. And I think if you are in a position where you are incapable of writing songs or incapable of being funny or incapable of writing books or doing paintings or whatever it is, it's because of whoever you are right now. But that doesn't mean that whoever you are right now is who you're going to be 5 years from now or whatever. I think if you can go through enough personal growth and enough introspective thinking and objective realization of your environment, and then the way you interface with people slowly but surely changes and evolves and matures your art will, your expression will, because you're not who you were. You know, you're not who you were 5 years ago. You're not who you were 10 years ago.
Okay.
This is my thought. I mean, I don't think it works with everybody. There's some people that just aren't fucking funny. Don't get me wrong. But I used to think that it was just, if you sucked in the beginning, you're going to suck. And then I met some people that
sucked. But there has to be some, you know,
spark
or drive,
yes.
Even, you know, like, I think if, would you say that if the person that was trying to be funny was not funny at first, they at least knew that they weren't funny and had to get better at it?
No. No. Sometimes they think they're funny and then they become funny. It's like I used to think that there was much more of a clear, defined pattern than I think now. But I think it's about being clueless. I think cluelessness is the enemy of anything that you're going to make that's going to have a real impact on people. If you're clueless, if you don't see how people perceive you, if you're not aware of how they're taking you in when you're communicating with them, your art is going to suck. Like,
really?
You don't have a connection with them. You don't have a connection with people. You don't have a connection with yourself. I think unless there's some sort of a solitary thing that you do, like maybe sculpting or painting, like you could be a madman who's like totally like in your own world and create some crazy art form that someone can come along and look at and go, wow.
Yeah.
But anything where you're interacting with people, I think there's a big part of that interaction is the way you look through other people's eyes and the way they take in what you're saying, not just what you want to get out, but also your recognition, some sort, whether peripherally or whether it's obviously, your realization of how they're perceiving your thoughts and ideas, and what vehicle you're delivering these ideas in. Is it clunky and too loud, or do you have the same thought and make it smooth and calm and sinking into people with the right words and the right cadence and the right? You can have the same ideas, but they need a better vehicle to get through. And I think cluelessness prevents you from objectively analyzing your own work.
Gotcha. So self-awareness.
Yeah, self-awareness
is a really important part.
And brutal honesty. you know,
with yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Need that.
I'll go with that.
Yeah. I mean, you must have that with songs, right? Like, do you have songs where you write and then you go back and what the fuck is this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but you also have songs where, you know, you write every day, you write a song and you get done. You don't get to the end of the day without thinking that you did something good.
Right.
But it's only on, you know, you got to get away from it a little bit and then like re-listen to it or re-examine it and go, eh, or, hey, that right. was a good one, you know. That, so I think it's easy to feel like you were a genius in the moment.
Right.
As a songwriter.
Especially if you got a couple of drinks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you, like, how much of the stuff that you actually write becomes a song that you publish? Like say if you're writing, like how many of the days spent does it actually come out to be like a full song?
Oh, I can write a song in 3 hours.
Really? Yeah, but you can also not write a song in 3 hours, right?
Yeah, if I don't want to. I'm like, are you asking if there's like a schedule to write?
No. I mean, like, how much of it like really connects with you? Like, I'm sure you must be sitting, sometimes you sit down and on the first draft you just fucking nail it, right? You got an inspiration.
Oh yeah, me every time. No.
But I'm just trying to see if there's parallels between, because comedy is probably 10 to 1. 10 things I write are bullshit and one thing I'm like, might be something there.
Yeah, I think if you're doing 10% of what you do is work that you deem good enough to put out into the world, I think you're probably doing pretty good. I mean, I think that's a pretty good average of things that are worth something. You know, you hope for better, but that if you're doing that, I think that's doing your job. But you got to go. I also believe you got to go through some of the ones that aren't there just to kind of flush them out.
Right, right.
You have to get that out. Otherwise, it's stuck there, and it's gonna mess with everything else you're doing. Just you know, if there's something on your mind to work on it to the end, make it the best you can make it, then look at it and go, hey, was this really something I should have worked on?
Right.
Yes or no. And then you can push it out and kind of move on. I think that's important to kind of flush out your mind that way creatively.
Do you ever come back to your stuff, like sort of almost like come back to it when you haven't thought about it in forever and look at it with fresh eyes, like almost like you're collaborating with somebody else and redoing their stuff?
No, I'm very much the guy who believes like the first instinct is probably the correct one most of the time.
Interesting.
I don't like to go back and edit and edit and edit. It's not me.
Really?
Yeah.
So when you write a song, you write a song.
Pretty much.
Wow, that's interesting. Does everybody do it that way?
Not at all. There are guys who will take a whole year to write one song.
Really?
And I can't write with those guys. I respect them, but I don't have that kind of patience. I don't. And they've written some songs that I think are fantastic, and I really do appreciate them. But I'm completely impatient writing songs. I feel like, you know, my favorite songs are ones that just kind of fall down out of the sky in a bolt of lightning, and you write it in about 10 minutes, and you're like, that's exactly what it was supposed to be.
Right.
Great. I'm done. I'm going to go eat a sandwich.
Right. How much of your shit do you write under the influence of something?
I don't like that.
Really?
Really, to do that.
Nothing?
I'm going to have a sip of bourbon or something, but it's I don't like that much because I like the clarity. Some guys can't do it without it.
Right.
And some guys it's like that makes them all of a sudden turn into the Michael Jordan of songwriting, you know, but it just, that's for me, if I'm going to do something like that, it's recreational and I'm going to go, you know, eat a bunch of chips and watch a movie or something.
Right.
It's just like, I'm not going to get any real, not much worthwhile is going to come out of that for me.
Yeah. That's it's an interesting thing that people have this different approach to essentially what's an open-ended creative avenue. You know, like creating a song, it's like it's a blank sheet of paper and
right.
it's your idea. And so many different people have different approaches to how to make that thing come out of their head.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not saying that I haven't tried many different ways to make things happen. But yeah, I find you know, for me, the process, the clarity works better than trying to alter myself to get to some other plane.
Mm.
But
yeah.
Maybe there is another plane I don't know about, but I've never been there.
Right. I would want, like, George Carlin had an interesting way that he wrote comedy. He would write comedy sober, and then he would smoke a joint and punch it up.
Huh.
Yeah. So he'd write the initial ideas, he'd write it all out, write out the bit, and then he'd, okay, let's look at this thing again. And then,
well, I mean, I think that probably works in comedy.
I've started adopting that.
Did you?
I used to write almost all high.
Yeah.
And now I write 50% high, 50% sober, and then I punch up high.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, but not too high.
And punch up is a comedic term for editing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it depends on some styles of writing. Some guys write in bit form. Like they say, so, the other day I walked, and they write it out like
right.
that. And other guys would just, like, say clocks. Like the idea of clocks, like the arbitrary decision that we all made that there's, you
right.
know, these numbers around this dial, this it's a minute, is this amount of time, and like,
right.
and you'll just start writing all these different things, and then out of that you might write a whole essay. Out of that you might have one paragraph that makes sense, like
right.
one quick one-liner about time. You know, so
yeah.
maybe it's an answer to a pretentious friend. It's like, there is no time, man.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you fucking show up late and you get fired, it's time for you to get a new job, bitch. You know what I mean? Like, that
yeah.
could be a way where you could take time and,
right.
you know, and just take, like, this big essay on it, and you would extract an idea that could eventually be humor on stage. But everybody's got a different style of that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a lot of thinking.
Fuck, man. It's all a lot of thinking, right? Dude, that's why I always love talking to people that do something completely different than me, like you. Because
yeah.
I always want to know, like, how does a guy who writes books do this? How does a guy who writes songs do this? How does a guy who makes movies do this?
Right.
You know?
Because it seems like it's a lot of the same muscles, but then in talking here, I'm not sure that the processes are exactly... I don't know that they always translate.
I think the focus is the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like whatever your end goal is, whatever you're trying to create, it's all about showing up and doing that work and staring at it and trying to figure it out. And then for comedy, it's a lot about getting in front of the crowds. You got to
yeah.
work a lot. If you don't work a lot, it's not going to work. It just
yeah.
won't. You have to be out there. You can't just create comedy on your own, whereas I think you, with a bunch of, like, talented musicians, you could probably develop a fucking jamming record before anybody ever got a chance to see it.
And that's what you do.
Yeah, yeah. It's a completely different style of creation.
Although we do try things out on the road, you
mm-hmm.
know, like, and you kind of get a feel for them sometimes that way. So, yeah, we do some of that, absolutely. But probably not as much as what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's a different art form, right? Do you ever do things specifically with the intention of getting material out of it?
Like in life?
Yeah, like go do something. Like maybe if I go do this, I'll you know, figure out, I'll get some songs out of this or something.
You know, I don't know that I ever specifically do something to get material out of it, but I do things because something comes up and I go, that sounds so weird, I'm going to go do that.
And then from that,
either good things happen or I have a story that
yeah.
sounds like it's fake.
That might be the best way to do it, right? To just live a happy, fulfilled life and mine that happy, fulfilled life for ideas rather than chase interesting things with a specific intention of turning them into creativity.
Yeah, no, I don't think I ever do that, but I go do things that might make me uncomfortable or, you know, put myself in situations where, like, this sounds like the weirdest thing ever.
Like what?
Well, you know, the case in point, and that turned out to be, you know, we're now good friends. But, you know, the first time I ever met Timberlake.
Timberlake?
Yeah, I got a call to basically play at his birthday party. His wife called me. This is no lie. Like, he'd seen a YouTube video or something. And said, "Hey, would you come play?" I thought I was getting punked or something. and I was just like, and the conversation went, and his wife, Jessie, she was like, "Yeah, I'm, you know, there's not a lot of things that he's done. A lot of things. It's hard for me to find new experiences for him." And so I was wondering if you would like to come play at his birthday party. And so I'm thinking, and so this is what you came up with. You know,
right.
this dude he saw a YouTube video on, get him to come play at his birthday party. And it turned out to be fine. And we hung out, on paper, to me, it was just like, this is really strange. I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But out of that, we've become friends and done things together and good things have come out of it, you know, but there was no intent out of it other than I thought it would be interesting to go do. And so I went and hung out and it turned out to be great. And we're good friends now. And
that's pretty badass.
Yeah. But that's how we met.
Look at you two.
Yeah, there we are. And I was literally his birthday present 1 year. So
that's wild, man. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I think that might be the formula. Just if you can, just do things that you find interesting and just have those as being like excellent side adventures in your life.
Right. And you know, nobody else has to understand it but you. And that's the cool part about it. You know, like people used to get onto me. I used to be in a bluegrass band. And they're like, why are you spending time being in a bluegrass band? Well, out of being in that bluegrass band, I got a cut on Adele.
Right.
So that who would have thought that was the X A plus B equals C formula for that?
Right.
Go be in a bluegrass band, and you'll get a pop cut on the biggest pop star in the world.
Isn't that funny, though, that someone would say, hey, why do you want to be in a bluegrass band? Well, they wouldn't say, hey, why do you like going fishing?
I don't know. It's just like it. Yeah, I like it.
Why do you like bowling?
Right. It's interesting to me.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna follow that road until it ends or takes a curve or runs off a cliff.
Do you do anything specifically to try to enrich your mind? Do you read a lot or anything?
I'm not a huge reader. I do play a lot of. I just play a lot of guitar. I think that's my thing that I really kind of internalize on.
Like almost like a meditation?
Yes, absolutely. If I'm feeling bad or in a bad headspace, I'm going to pick up a guitar. If I'm, that's what I do. That's if there's a centering thing, I'm going to pick up a guitar to get there for me. I don't know if that's mind, if that's flexing your mind a little bit.
But it is. It's something.
But I, you know, playing the guitar is one of those things where you never think that you're ever getting any better at it until one day you wake up and you understand something that you didn't understand and hadn't understood for the 10 years you've been trying to understand it. And then all of a sudden you have this new space to live in on it. And then it's the coolest thing in the world to me.
Whoa. I know what you're saying, but I don't know what
you're
saying.
It's like plateauing at working out or something.
You know, yeah.
Like
you hit a new level.
Like you're working out and you're working out and you're working out and you work out for 10 years and you never get – you hit this point where you're like, all right, this is the peak of what I have. And then someday, for some unknown reason, your body or something, it makes sense and all of a sudden you could do something that you could never do before. And that's what playing the guitar is.
I kind of understand the space you're talking about, and I think that applies to a lot of different things. You know, there's this Miyamoto Musashi quote that I use all the time. Once you understand the way broadly, you see it in all things. And that this place that you're talking about, like these new level places, like that exists in martial arts, it exists in comedy, it exists in writing, it exists in... I'm sure it exists in music, although I don't do music.
Right.
It's just, I think this thing of this Zen samurai thing you're talking about, of just like this constant focus until you reach some new understanding of the thing.
And you don't even know how you're getting there, but you're working towards something that you don't know what it is until you get there.
Yeah.
And then you get it, and you have this new piece of knowledge, and it's a new, all of a sudden you're something new too. And maybe that's the thing you were talking about earlier about people who suck at comedy, all of a sudden they're funny,
yeah.
You know, like that's what I get off on is finding that, you know, and I don't claim to be, you know, I'm not like, I don't belong in, you know, Gary Clark Jr. world or anything like that. But I do love guitar enough to know that I'm always playing enough to try to find that new space to live. And that's the coolest thing in the world to me, because I'll never get to whatever. There's never an end to it.
Right, right. Yeah, there's no perfection.
There's no perfection. There's never an end to it. It's just a constantly trying to get better at doing what you do, or being you, trying to make yourself better.
Yeah. And that thing seems to manifest itself more with a singular focus, like guitar.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. You have to be, like, way obsessed with one thing.
Yeah.
And that's it for me, for the most part.
Chris Stapleton, you're a bad motherfucker. Thank you for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, man. It's been a real joy.
It's a real honor, man. Thank
Absolutely.
You. Go buy his shit, folks. It's fucking awesome. All right. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye.